A midweek Wednesday, July 8th edition of Connecticut Today, right here on WICC. 3 p.m. hour, Dr. Enrique Sala joined us. He's a world-renowned marine biologist. Talked about whether or not areas right off the Connecticut and Long Island coasts are being overfished. And our monthly check-in with Chris Powell, noted columnist from the Manchester Journal Inquirer, took place in the 5 o'clock hour. Chris talking about the situations in the state with more apparent corruption in Hartford and the attitudes towards Connecticut's police officers. I remember that a couple of weeks ago, and I do remember when this story was in the news, President Trump met with some commercial fishermen up north in Bangor, Maine. And he signed an order opening up what's known as the Atlantic National Monument to Commercial Fishing. Now, there's some people who do not think that's a good idea. Joining us right now is a renowned ecologist. He's director of National Geographic's Pristine Seas Project. He is the author of the forthcoming book, The Nature of Nature. It goes on sale this August 25th. He wants to talk about this national monument and the effects of increased fishing. We welcome to Connecticut Today, Dr. Enrique Sala. Dr. Sala, Paul here. How are you today, sir?
Hello, Paul. Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Sala, thank you. When we talk about a national monument as far as an area of the waters, an area, a fishing area, what are we talking about exactly here? And if you could give my listeners kind of a rough geographic reference of the area that you're concerned with here.
Yes, national monuments are areas that are part of the fabric of our country. They are like our national parks in the ocean. They are invaluable pieces of the natural heritage of all Americans. These are sacred places that are protected from activities that harm objects of cultural, historic, or scientific interest. Mm-hmm. And it is the power of the president using the Antiquities Act, which was passed in 1906, signed by Teddy Roosevelt, that allows the president of the United States to create a national monument without having to go through Congress.
Mm-hmm. Now, this monument here, the Atlantic National Monument, Dr. Sala, give me a little bit of a reference here, and for my listeners, geographically, what's basically the area that we're talking about here? If you could kind of give us kind of a word map here to follow, what's the area that you're concerned about here?
Yeah, this is an area that it's called the Northeast Canyons and Seamounts Marine National Monument.
Okay.
It is the only monument in the Atlantic coast of the U.S. It's about 5,000 square miles, and it's located offshore, far offshore, near the drop where the continental shelf of the U.S. drops off of New England.
So,
and this is a place.
So yeah, if there was a reference, doctor, say I was looking at the shore of Maine or the New England coastline, is this area parallel to that? Is it north of that, south of that? Whereabouts would this area of concern be?
Yeah, this is an area that is straight off the coast of, if you're looking at the Atlantic Ocean,
yeah,
from Providence, Rhode Island.
Okay.
It's like if you're New York, you know, if you are in New York, you're looking east. Mm-hmm. So this area is a couple hundred miles east of New York.
Got it. So this is not
the coast of Georges Bank.
Oh, got it. So this is not an immediate coastal area. This is quite a bit out into open water. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct. And most of the monument is hundreds of meters deep. And it's home to deep corals, some of which are thousands of years old, and fish that live really deep. So this is far offshore, and it's a place that, before the creation of the monument by President Obama, received very little fishing pressure.
And why is that? Is that, Dr. Sala, because it is so far out? Was it inconvenient for commercial fishermen to head out there? Or did they just know that this was an area that they could not go to? Is that why?
It's a combination of this. There are people fishing for tuna, and they go offshore. They go near George's Bank. There are people fishing for scallops also, and they go farther offshore. There are people fishing for crabs and lobsters who are fishing closer to shore. There are so many species that are found closer to shore, so fishermen don't have the need to go so far away.
Okay, so this increased fishing now that the president has okayed, that you and some other folks are concerned with, this would be done quite a bit out into this pristine area, you say?
Yeah, well, this doesn't make any sense, because the argument of President Trump and the fishermen that were at this round table a month ago in Maine, the argument was that the monument destroyed the fishing industry of New England. But this is not the issue. You know, opening the national monument to fishing, to commercial fishing, is like using eye drops to treat coronavirus. No, the real issue is something else.
All right, and what would that be? Talk about what the real issue you think here, using that example, which I think is fascinating. Go ahead.
Yeah, there are several factors. One is that the coronavirus, the pandemic, dramatically reduced the demand for seafood and broke the supply chains, leaving fishing boats on the dock, you know, without a significant market to sell to. That's one big thing. Sure. It's not a lack of supply of fish. It is a lack of demand right now. And as restaurants reopen, some of these boats will be able to go back and catch lobster and other species and, closer to shore. Second problem is that some of these fishermen complain about tariffs from China, but they failed to mention, or maybe didn't know, that China slapped tariffs on U.S. lobsters in 2018 as retaliation for the Trump administration's tariffs on Chinese products. So within a year, between June 2018 and June 2019, lobster exports to China fell 81%. If that's not enough, ocean warming is pushing lobsters towards the north into the colder waters of Canada. Lobsters don't like warm waters, and ocean warming is increasing the temperature in Maine faster than the average of the ocean. So what helped bring lobsters to Maine is now driving them away, right? So again, dismissing the impacts of climate change and pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement does not help New England fishermen. And on top of all of this, New England has a fisheries management system that has historically allowed overfishing and caused fisheries collapses and economic ruin. So all the evidence we have is crying loudly that everything but the monument is harming coastal communities in New England.
Doctor, hang on. I want to be right back with you. Some fascinating stuff. I want to get into the theory of overfishing here and what happens in that situation. So hang on, please. Dr. Enric Sala is the guest, National Geographic Explorer in Residence. His upcoming book is called The Nature of Nature. It's coming out this August 25th, talking about an order signed by the president recently that would open up a specific national monument off the east coast of the U.S., far out in the water, about 200 miles, to more commercial fishing. Dr. Sala, hang on. Traffic and weather together, 316 on WICC. And we continue with a fascinating gentleman. Dr. Enric Sala is the guest. He's the National Geographic Explorer in Residence. His new book is due soon, The Nature of Nature. That comes out on August 25th. Dr. Sala, very concerned about a move that President Trump made to appease some fishermen in the Maine area about opening up commercial fishing in what's called the Northeastern Canyons and Seamounts Marine National Monument, as Dr. Sala told us, and a monument a couple hundred miles off of the shore of the east coast of New England. Picture, you know, the New York area to Rhode Island and out east. That's what we're talking about here. Dr. Sala, talk to me about or explain to my listeners the theory of, and I've always found this fascinating, overfishing and how too much fishing in an area, whether it's this monument or not, how is that determined and what are the long and short-term effects of that?
So overfishing basically is taking fish out of the ocean faster than they can reproduce. This is like we have an investment account at the bank, and we are not only withdrawing the returns, but we are withdrawing part of the principal every year. So you don't need to be an economist or a banker to know what's happening to that bank account. You know, the more we take away from the principal, the lower the returns, and the lower the entire capital we have. And this is what's been happening in the ocean, not only off New England, but all around the world. You know, there are these global fisheries statistics that have been compiled by the United Nations that show that fisheries catch in the ocean, wild fisheries, increased since 1950s, after Second World War. But we reached a peak in the mid-90s. So we reached peak fish 24 years ago.
Okay.
And the catch, the global catch, has been declining since.
Are we fishing too much? Are we eating too much fish? Or is there a safe level here, Dr. Sala, of what commercial fishermen, say, in this area, New England, and all over the country and the world should be doing here? Is there a balance here or not?
There should be a balance. There has to be a balance, but there is no balance because we have been overfishing almost everywhere. Two-thirds of the fish stocks that are caught today around the world are experiencing overfishing, which means that they are on the way to collapse unless we reduce the fishing effort. And this is, you know, this is not rocket science. We cannot take fish out of the water faster than they can reproduce. And when the fish reach levels of abundance that are dangerously low, when they are close to collapse, we need to give them a break. And in the United States, we have great examples of species that where there have been moratoria. We stopped fishing for a while, or we reduced the quotas, and about 20 of these stocks have been rebounding.
Yeah. And how is this? How is this enforced, Doctor? I mean, is it when these commercial fishermen come in? Is it strictly, you know, the weighing their catch, inspectors, things like that? I mean, do we have a robust enough system here to keep that in place and to keep from overfishing and killing some of these species?
In theory, that's how it should work. But federal fisheries managers allow many fishing boats to operate on an owner system, which just doesn't have enough checks and balances. So we have a biased knowledge about what's actually happening on the water.
Your new book is coming out, The Nature of Nature. Tell us a little about that, and why do you think it might be an interesting read for folks in my audience?
The Nature of Nature is my love letter to the planet. I've been conducting scientific research for the last 30 years with our National Geographic Pristine Seas Project. We have been working with communities and governments to create marine reserves similar to this national monument to help bring marine life back and help replenish the waters around them so that fishermen can have better livelihoods. And The Nature of Nature is my story of how nature works. How is it possible to have 9 million species of plants and animals on the planet and a trillion different types of microbes interacting, interdepending, and it just works? You know, life on the planet made the planet inhabitable. So I make a scientific case for why we need wild places, for why we need to protect more of nature. I make a moral case, an economic case, and also I was able to put a final chapter there before the book went to print during the pandemic, because this coronavirus pandemic is the loudest wake-up call we've had in recent times about the fact that we are all connected. Your health, my health, the health of the richest person in the richest country today is dependent on the health of the poorest person in the poorest country, as we have seen through this pandemic.
What made you fall in love with marine biology?
You know, just exposure to the sea. When I was a little boy growing up on the Mediterranean coast of Spain, I was watching the documentaries of Jacques Cousteau on TV, the undersea world of Jacques
Cousteau.
Remember
those,
And I dreamed with being, do you remember? So many people were inspired by by those stories of exploration. To me, it was a dream. I wanted to be one of Cousteau's divers and explore the world. And then but when I went swimming in the Mediterranean of my childhood, I was confused because all the big animals, the dolphins, whales, seals, groupers that Cousteau showed us in his documentaries, they were not there. I couldn't see them.
Couldn't find
them. And, you know, I thought, yeah, well, the Mediterranean is probably the most historically overfished sea on the planet.
Sure.
You know, the people have been fishing there for millennia. And I just didn't know when I was a little kid. I thought that the Mediterranean was not special and that all these beautiful things were to be seen only in exotic locations. But as I grew up and I studied marine biology, I realized that I learned that it is not that the Mediterranean was a poor sea, is that we have been taking our out of the ocean too much for too long.
Doctor, thank you. There's a lot of fishermen around here, fishermen and fisherwomen all up and down the New England coast in our market, and we thank you for the time. I'm sure they would find the book fascinating, The Nature of Nature. It's on sale August 25th. He is the National Geographic Explorer-in-Residence, talking about the move to open up commercial fishing in the Northeastern Canyons and Seamounts Marine National Monument in the Atlantic, Dr. Enrique Sala. Dr. Sala, thank you. We appreciate the time, and be safe.
Thank you so much, Paul.
Appreciate it, Dr. Enrique Sala. Thank you for once again reinforcing to me and to all of your readers that just when we think there's light and at the end of the tunnel, there actually might not be. So, Chris, thank you so much for that. I appreciate
it. It's my job, Paul. Thank you.
And you do it so eloquently, too, Chris. It's wonderful. Chris Powell's with us from the Manchester JI. Chris, hope you're well. You had a column earlier this week, yesterday's column, on Tuesday. And, boy, I got to tell you, just when you think, especially amid all the stuff we're going through now with the realization that we need to clamp down on this police brutality, what exists of it in a racial sense, especially in that time now, we are just still somehow battling instances of irresponsibility and corruption or things that look corrupt, as we always do. Talk about the case, Chris, and what happened of Gail Hardy, because I'm sure my listeners may not know this.
Yeah, Gail Hardy is the state's attorney, or has been the state's attorney for the Hartford Judicial District for many years. She got into trouble a few months ago because the Hartford Current disclosed that she had neglected for years to complete and file reports on four fatal shootings by police officers. After the Current reported this, it was a pretty big scandal, and the Criminal Justice Commission, which supervises the prosecutors, was very unhappy with her and commissioned a little investigation about it. She apologized, but she very soon was up for reappointment. And the last week, the commission was about to reject her for reappointment and effectively to fire her when she abruptly withdrew her application for reappointment while the commission was meeting. And was immediately appointed as special executive assistant to the chief state's attorney, Richard Colangelo, and she'll be in charge of fostering diversity among prosecutors. She'll get an annual salary of $151,000, and it's a position that was, you know, not even yet formally budgeted, defined, or advertised. It was just something they met up for on the spot, and I had to think that the commission had decided to remove her as state's attorney, but to keep her around in a very cushy, made-up job because she's black. And they figured that, it would look racist if they treated the negligent black state's attorney in Hartford as they would treat a negligent white state's attorney, somebody who had failed to investigate those shootings and report on them as required. If a white state's attorney had failed so badly, I'm sure he would have been fired. But she's black, and I think they figured, gee, that would look bad now that, you know, bad as she is, negligent as she was, we can't fire a black employee, so they made up a special position for her and didn't even let anybody else apply, and now she's got a sinecure for $151,000 a year. I suspect the commission was also a little concerned that if they did fire her, she probably knows some things that are embarrassing and she'd be talking out of school, and so they basically bought her silence. And you know, that's the way things work. You know, it's, you know, the government is not only corrupt in favor of its black employees, it's corrupt in favor of its white employees in many instances too. But you know, this irregularity I think very clearly has a racial component, and it just can't be discussed because it's too sensitive.
Does anybody know why Chris Powell, Gail Hardy, as you say, a black Hartford State's attorney, didn't complete records of four incidents, as you say, where people had been killed by police officers for years? Was it being lazy? Was it not wanting to? I mean, how do you let that go? I know it sounds like a dumb question, but how do you let that go?
Well, she apologized for it, but there's no explanation for it, but negligence and incompetence. You know, if the Kern hadn't called attention to it, you know, it might have gone on for forever. You know, if in the circumstances we have today, with all the screaming about, you know, racism, real and imagined, it seems that the Criminal Justice Commission decided that no, we can't afford to fire a black person now.
And that hundred, as you point out in the column, Chris, so she gets appointed to a new position with no competitive, no EOE recommendations or requirements to get all different kinds of applications, as you have to in the news business do and we have to in the radio business. You know, Chris, this, I hate to use the term, but this kind of reeks of almost protection money that they're paying her, as you say, if she knows where certain metaphorical bodies are buried.
Well, you can't help but think that, Paul. You know, let the commission deny it. Let the commission come back and say anything about this at all. I'm sure the commission just wants this to go away quietly, and you know, it will go away quietly. But it's just amazing that you can, you know, a government agency can make up a job on the spur of the moment for $151,000 a year. You know, no advertising, no searching for, you know, qualified applicants. It's great to be in government.
And again, yeah, and Chris, and the whole thing is that just echoes the arrogance that drives my listeners crazy, and obviously, you know, your readers and people who send you letters to the editor, the JI. You know what, Chris? You and I in these positions, we shake our heads and we say, yeah, folks, this goes on, but unfortunately, you know, who's minding the store here? It's just, it's mind-numbing sometimes. It really is.
Well, you know, people can complain about it if they want to. I think the public is, on the whole, I think, too demoralized by too many things in government to complain about things that we should complain about. But I mean, the state government is catastrophically broke now. There's going to be billions of dollars in tax losses and billions of dollars in unexpected expenses because of the virus epidemic, and yet our government managed to just decide, oh, here's $151,000 to keep this one around. I mean, you know, they act as if the money is bottomless.
Chris, hang on. I'm going to be back to talk with you about your column that comes out tomorrow, which is another maddening thing. Chris Powell is the guest, Manchester J.I. Chris, hang on. Back with you after we do traffic and weather together, 516 on WICC. Chris Powell, the guest. We like to have Chris on around once a month or so. Outstanding editorial columnist for the Manchester J.I., the former managing editor there. Chris, you have a column coming out tomorrow just touching on an incident or two regarding some of the things that police officers in the state here are facing in this time of, shall we say, heightened tension.
Yeah, Paul, you know, cops are, I think, getting a bad name generally because, you know, there's been some bad mistakes by cops around the country and even here in Connecticut, you know, as if all the rest of us never make mistakes, as if all the rest of us are never even badly motivated or malicious or corrupt. I mean, this happens everywhere. But On Independence Day evening, last Saturday, three Hartford cops were called to a neighborhood where there was a big fireworks party going on, and there were complaints about the noise. And when the police got there, they were pelted with explosives, some of them pretty big, and one of the explosives even went off as it struck an officer's chest. It was very fortunate he was not seriously injured, but he could have been killed or maimed or blinded. This was an atrocity. Three cops injured responding to a complaint about a fireworks party on Independence Day, and what happens? They're attacked by the people with fireworks. Mm-hmm. And this was just taken as if it's a normal sort of thing in Connecticut. The mayor, Luke Bronin, made a statement about how outrageous it was, and the city council president put out a statement saying people shouldn't do this, but nobody else said anything about it. The story was really underplayed throughout the news organizations in Connecticut. And, you know, I have to wonder if all this, racist exaggeration that's been going on motivated this attack. And I had to wonder if our police here in Connecticut, you know, most of whom are, you know, perfectly decent people, are beginning to feel like the sheriff in the movie High Noon from 1952, where Gary Cooper is standing up against a vicious criminal gang, and nobody in the town will help him. And just remarkably, in the concluding gunfight at the end of the movie, he manages to take down the gangsters one by one, and then when the battle's over, the townspeople come out to the main street and surround the sheriff to marvel at his triumph over the gangsters. And he takes the badge off his vest and mm-hmm. tosses it in the dirt and rides off in contempt. And I'm fearful that we're inviting the police to feel the same way by what we're doing. We're tarring them all, and yeah. calling them names, and they're the only protection we have against the social yeah. disintegration that is consuming so much of Connecticut and the nation right now. And I think it's gone a little bit too far. And you know, there's no denying the police brutality. I mean, I one of my hobby horses is the state police mm-hmm. Troopers Union contract, yeah. which prohibits disclosure of brutality complaints. It's an outrage, but it's a second outrage that the legislators who are complaining now about police brutality all yeah. voted for the damn contract.
Well, yeah, and now
they're against brutality after they voted to conceal it.
And you know, Chris, we saw today there was a big news conference, hastily called news conference in Hartford on the steps where outside somewhere where everybody was beating their breasts and their heads about the Supreme Court ruling, the 7-2 ruling on the Little Sisters of the Poor. For God's sake, they won that one, thankfully. But yeah, where are all these people, or the civil rights groups, or for that matter, Chris, the vocal members of the General Assembly? Where's the state leadership when something like this happens in Hartford, where people should all get together and say enough, enough? Where are they?
Well, I think people are just so thoroughly intimidated by accusations of racism, no matter how unfair or wrong they are. They're just intimidated. And, our own elected officials will not stand up for democratic government these days. Somebody knocks a statue over and, nobody's going to say anything about it. I mean, we certainly have the democratic right to change the heroes and to remove statues, but we don't have the right to do it outside the democratic process. And when we sit quietly for this bypassing of the democratic process, and our elected officials do not have the self-respect and do not have the respect for the government that they lead to insist on democratic norms, we are in big trouble.
And we will leave it at that. Always on an upbeat note, Chris. That's why I have you on. Chris Powell, Manchester Journal Inquirer. Read the columns. They come out twice a week. Best to read in Connecticut. Chris, thank you so much as well. Take care of yourself. Stay safe, and we'll be in touch. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul.
Thanks. Appreciate it. Well, there you go, folks. He's right. He's 100% right.